Before we begin tonight, we want to make welcome Tyler Skinner, who has let it be known that he wants to be a part of our family here. Is Tyler here? There he is, sitting okay. And I want to welcome Tyler and make him welcome here at the River Chase family, and we're delighted to have him with us. You may have noticed a couple pair of tennis shoes when you were driving into the building tonight. They are right there. All trails indicated that they belong to somebody coming in here. And so pick those up, and they are in front. If they are yours, then others have endangered their life for you, and you can go ahead and pick those up. And they may have been on top of a car or something, but we're not exactly sure. But you can pick those up if they are yours. And if you happen to know who they belong to, you can get them to the right person. I won't say we will all be watching, but cameras will be at the ready and will be turned, but you can pick them up whenever you wish. I meant this morning to make one other announcement, because I know we're such a fluid congregation from the standpoint people are in and out all of the time. I'll probably go ahead and do it again next Sunday morning. You've been so generous with the help and support for the mission trips that our teenagers take. And we made one announcement about that and received a substantial amount to help cover that. Not enough to bring us up to what we normally get, but we wanted to make another announcement with regard to that. If you would like to help with some of the mission efforts that our teens and others have been on for this summer, then we would love for you to turn that in to someone in the office, to one of the elders, or to Scott for sure, and we'll get those out. Talking about it, he laughs tonight, and I have a prop. And I don't think it's going to work. Bill Baker thought that I could not do this lesson without this, so he wanted to make sure I had one. But actually, he said I didn't have to wear it tonight, but I could use it for other purposes. And I'm sure my grandkids will love it. And so we will save it for another purpose. I better not put it in that pocket, because when I take the microphone out, it'll come out with it. So I'll put it over in this pocket. He laughs. To borrow an expression that is used in connection with God and describing God and how he differs from the idols that children of Israel were prone to worship. The God who made the ears, do you not think he can hear? The God who made the eyes, do you not think he can see? And the God who made the voice, the mouth, do you not think he can speak? And the same thing is the case in connection with God and laughter. Do we not think God can laugh? When he gave laughter to us, and we enjoy it. But the laughter of God is present. It is there, and there are several different things that are said about it in the Bible. But when we focus about God laughing, it's rather unique. And we're going to take a look at that tonight, and we're going to take a look at some verses where God and his laughter is described. And we learn a lot by the description that is given, that it helps us to understand and see some things about God and some things that we need to understand about our relationship with him. And I think when we see his laughter, we are brought to that, and we are able to see that in a very striking way. And in connection with that, before, I know it sounds like we're rambling, but I'm not. I'm kind of getting a whole list of things out before we go through these list of verses. There's a passage in the book of Ephesians that warns us against coarse jesting. And the idea of coarse jesting is a troubling expression. It may take several different ideas or thoughts about what that might mean. But just with the two words that are put together, the idea of coarse jesting seems to be jesting or joking in a way that's inappropriate and not proper. And one of the ways that that might be is to turn something that is serious with regard to wrongdoing or something serious that God says and make a joke out of it in order to diminish the seriousness of the thing that is wrong, or diminish the seriousness of the thing that God has spoken or the thing that God has said. And that might be one of the ideas behind coarse jesting. But let's take a look at some verses and take a look at laughter. First of all, from an aspect of which God wants us to laugh. And He wants us to enjoy laughing. And it will be a gift that He gives to us. Luke chapter 6, verse 21. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you will be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. A promise from God. Not anything wrong at all with laughing, but it becomes a part of the blessing that God has for us. In the book of Genesis chapter 17, verse 17 is the first mention of laughing. And it's mentioned again right after that in Genesis chapter 18. Genesis chapter 17, verse 17 is Abraham. When God tells him that he and Sarah are going to have a child, the Bible tells us that Abraham falls to the ground and he laughs. And he says, "How can this be?" And God assures him that it's going to be exactly that way. But Abraham's first response is laughter. But it's a laughter brought on by disbelief. Brought on by being overwhelmed by the impossible. And because it was something that he knew that would be absolutely impossible, his reaction to God's word was laughter. Is this going to happen to us? And God assures him that he does, that it will, and that it is. And Abraham believes God. Genesis chapter 18, the angels come to make that pronouncement again. A year before Isaac is going to be born. And the angels that come specifically ask, "Where's Sarah?" And Abraham says, "She's in the tent." They don't go get her. They understand. Maybe Sarah doesn't want them to understand. But she is just inside the tent door, behind where the angels are, and she's listening. And when the angels tell them that a year from now, Sarah will have a son, and you and Sarah will have a child, and they say that to Abraham outside of the tent. And Sarah laughs to herself, same way Abraham did in Genesis 17. "Shall I have pleasure in my Lord when I am this old?" And she laughs to herself. And she may have been startled, and I'm sure she was, when the angels looked at her and said, doesn't look at her, but when the angels asked the question, "Why did Sarah laugh?" And Sarah very quickly says, "Oh, I didn't laugh." Boy, isn't she just like us. Lies come off of our lips so quick. Sometimes it's the first thing we think of is to deny the truth. But nobody heard her. She laughed inside. "I didn't laugh." "Oh, yes, you laughed," the angel said to her. "And a year from now, you will have your child." And a year from that time, they have their son, and his name is Isaac. Do you find humor in the Bible? I do, a lot of places. Sometimes it's in the idea of a figure of speech, a hyperbole, where you use exaggeration. But the whole idea of the exaggeration would create laughter, especially if you were there and you heard it, or you could take the time to stop and to visualize it. And God uses humor. And he does so in several different places. Let's take a look at just three. The first one is in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 7, verse 3. You had to be in the audience. As we sometimes will say, you had to be there. Why do you look at that little piece of speck of dirt, or that little piece of a speck of straw that's in your brother's eye, but you don't notice this sequoia tree that's coming out of yours? And those who would have heard it would have found humor in the exaggeration, which is exactly what Jesus intended to do. But there's something else in his humor. to show the foolishness of this action. That action like this is to be laughed at because it is absolutely foolish. And do we not realize and see how many times when we run into people who go around seeing everything that's wrong with somebody else and they never take a look at themselves, you almost can't help but laugh behind their back because of how foolish they are. And that's the way Jesus uses this. Do you not look at the speck that's in your brother's eye, but you take no notice of that log that's coming out of yours? And how foolish we are and how foolish we look, especially in the eyes of God. But my two favorite, the first one is Numbers 22. In Numbers 22, Balak has a problem with the children of Israel. They have come into his land and he doesn't want them there and he doesn't know what to do to get rid of them. And he has an idea about a prophet of God that he's aware of and that he knows. But what he knows about him is that whoever he curses is really cursed. And whoever he blesses is really blessed. Bad things happen if he curses you. And good things happen if he blesses you. So he calls for Balaam and he says, come here. And I want you to curse this people for me. And he sends some dignitaries. And he sends all the price for that would normally be expected to pay for a man who's going to do this kind of work for you. And when they come to Balaam, Balaam says, well, let me ask God, see what God wants me to do, and I'll give you back the answer. And God tells him, don't go with him. Don't go to that man, and do not curse those people at all, because they are blessed by me. And so Balaam comes out, and he tells all the people that Balak has sent, I can't go with you, because God has blessed these people. He's forbidden me to go. So they go back to Balak and they tell him he won't come. And Balak sends some more money and more dignified or higher ranking people. And they come back to Balaam and they beg him again. And this time Balaam says, well, let me go ask God. And whatever he says is what I'll have to do. And he goes into where God is and talks to God. And God says, okay, go with him. But God becomes angry because he knows what's going on in his mind. He knows what's going on in his heart. And he knows that the focus of Balaam is on the money. And the focus of Balaam is on the things that he can get. And so Balaam goes with them. And his two servants go with them. And to me, that's part of the visualization. You have to include the two servants in what's about to happen. Even though they are not mentioned again. But this is where it is so much better to read a book for yourself and not see the movie. Because you get to use your own visualization. And you get to use your own imagination. And I'm going to try my best not to use all of mine for you. You can use your own. But the angel is sent by God as an adversary against Balaam. And the angel comes and he stands in the road. And he has his sword drawn in order to stop Balaam. The donkey that Balaam is riding on sees the angel and he turns off the road and goes out into a field. And Balaam commences to beat him, get him back on the road. And the angel moves down a little further. And he moves down to a place where there are two walls on either side of the road. And he stands with his sword drawn. And the only one that can see him is the donkey. And the donkey sees him again. And he moves over to one of the walls. And he has to get so close to get around the angel that he presses Balaam's foot against the wall. And again, Balaam commences to beat him. And the angel moves down a little further. And he finds a narrow place in the road where there is no way to go around on either side. And there the angel stops and he draws his sword. And the donkey sees him. And when the donkey sees him and he realizes there's no way to go around, he simply kneels down to the ground and lays down on the ground and stops. And Balaam commences to beat him again. And the donkey turns his eyes toward Balaam and says, "Why are you hitting me?" Now, why this conversation continues, I have no idea. But this conversation continues. And it's at this point that I'm wondering about the two servants. Are they listening to this? Can they hear the donkey? Or are they kind of like the guys that were with Paul when that light shone from heaven and they heard a noise, but they didn't understand what the voice was saying? Are they hearing this donkey talk? And is that why there's no more mention of two servants? Have they fled the scene, or are they still there and just no longer a significant part? But the donkey says, "Why are you hitting me?" "Because you're making a mockery of me." You actually answer the donkey? And the donkey says, "Have I ever been in a habit of treating you this way? Have I ever been in the habit of not obeying you?" And the donkey makes you stop and think. The donkey makes you reason. And in response to the donkey, you give the answer of, "Well, no, you haven't." And then God opens his eyes and he sees the angel. And then he falls on his face. And God says, "Now go on. But don't you say a thing that I haven't said. And you make sure that you say exactly what I tell you to say and nothing more and nothing less." And so Balaam goes on. How many times through the rest of the year do you think Balaam tries to continue the conversation with the donkey? That just is something delightful for me to think about. Trying to get the donkey to talk again. You wonder if that happened, and you wonder if that occurred. But you talk about a drama in comedy. It's the book of Esther. The entire book of Esther is this comedy. We pick up after Esther has become the queen of Ahasuerus. She is in the castle, and there's an event that takes place that's important to the story, because there are two men that are plotting to kill the king, Ahasuerus. And Mordecai finds out about that plot, and he warns those who are responsible for the king about the plot, and they do investigation and find out that it's true. And the two men are caught, and they are brought before the king, and they are punished. They are put to death because they had intended to kill the king. And all of that is written down in the chronicles of the king. His diary that all the kings had. A record of it and everything that occurred was written down and put into the book so that it would be there as a historical reminder. Shortly after that, there is a man by the name of Haman who is appointed by the king to a very high position. And he is a man who is full of himself. And when Haman is appointed to be in this position, he walks around and he brags about who he is and what he is and how important he is to everyone. And he delights in the fact that everyone bows down to him. Everyone will stand up when he walks by or bow down if they're standing. Everyone does homage to him and everyone praises him and he loves it. There's a couple of other guys that notice that Mordecai doesn't bow down. And they keep asking him about it. And the only response that he gives is, "I'm a Jew." And that's his reason for not bowing down to Mordecai. And these two well-doers, wanting to make sure that everybody knows, especially the one being offended, what's going on with Mordecai, they go to Haman and they say, "Does Mordecai's excuse for not bowing down to you hold water? Is he justified in not bowing down to you, or nor recognizing you, nor honoring you because of what he says? He says he's a Jew, and therefore he's not going to do it." Well, that brought all kinds of trouble to the mind of Haman. And now all of a sudden, with all the people bowing down, he could only look at one man. And now his focus is on one man, Mordecai. And the more he sees him, and the more he sees that he doesn't stand up, and he doesn't bow down, and he doesn't give him any honor or recognition, the angrier and madder he gets. To the point that he is so infuriated by it, he can't stand it anymore. He tells his family and all those that are eating at his house, he doesn't have a whole lot of friends. We can't understand why. He doesn't have a whole lot of friends, but the ones that he have are over there, and he tells them, "I've been blessed above everything else, but I can't stand this guy, Mordecai." But then the queen invites him and the king to come to the house. And the reason they have is because the plot or the plan that Mordecai has is, not Mordecai, but Haman has, is to get rid of Mordecai. But Haman doesn't want to just get rid of one of these Jews. He wants to get rid of the whole nation. So he tells the king that there's a group of people in your land that do not do anything but cause trouble. See how gossip goes. And you see how exaggeration goes. And these people are individuals that will not obey the king's laws, and they will not follow the king's laws, and it would be in the king's best interest to get rid of all of these people. And for whatever reason, King Ahasuerus agrees. Put your plan together and let it be fulfilled. So he plans out for 12 months in advance. And on the 13th day of the 12th month, then a decree is going to be followed where all the Jews in all of the kingdom of Ahasuerus are to be killed and are to be destroyed. And those letters and posters go out all over the kingdom. And the Jews are terrified. And Mordecai comes and tells Esther. And Esther, just to shorten the story, you remember, invites the king and Haman to her house to eat a meal. They come and they eat and they have a great evening. But as the evening goes toward this end, the king will look at Esther and say, "Why did you bring us? What is it that you're wanting? Even up to half of my kingdom." And Esther will say to him, "If it pleases the king, let he and Haman come back to my house and eat again tomorrow night. And I will tell the king what I want." And Haman goes home walking on clouds. He's been at Queen Esther's house with the king. And he's been invited back tomorrow, and on the way home, he sees Mordecai, and Mordecai doesn't even pay him any attention, and he loses all joy and happiness in his countenance, and he goes home, and he faces his wife, and he's so upset, and he's so angry because of all the blessings that he's had. He sees Mordecai, and he is so mad, and his friends tell him, "Why don't you build a gallows and go in tomorrow morning and ask the king to hang him and have him hung and be rid of him?" So he does that. He has a gallows built that very night. The next day, he goes in to see the king. And the king can't sleep. And when he can't sleep, he gets up and he reads. And what does a king read about when he can't sleep? He reads about himself. So he opens up the book of the Chronicles of the King to see what's going on, and he reads the story about Mordecai and how Mordecai uncovered the plot to kill the king and save the king's life and allowed those men that were trying to destroy him to be destroyed themselves. And so the king asked those that are with him, what did we ever do for Mordecai? And they said, nothing. Nothing was ever done for Mordecai. And the king says, who's out in the hall? And they said, Haman. He said, tell Haman to come in. So Haman comes into the king, and the king looks at Haman, and he says, Haman, if the king wanted to honor somebody, to give special honor to someone, what should he do in order to honor someone? And Haman's eyes get big, and Haman's heart is pounding. And Haman is saying, who in all the kingdom would the king want to honor more than me? So king, here's what you need to do. Take one of the royal robes that you've worn and have one of your leading dignitaries put that robe on the one you want to honor. And then bring one of your horses, one of the horses that's had the king's crown on its head. And put the one you want to honor on that horse. And have that leading dignitary to lead that horse up and down the streets of the city all day long, shouting at the top of his voice. This is what the king does to the man that he wants to honor. And the king says, that's great, Haman. Go do that to Mordecai. Can you see that? Can you visualize Haman in the process of doing that? And he goes to his home when it's over and he's dejected. It has taken all day. He went in the morning and now it's time for supper that night. And he goes into his house and he's dejected and he tells his family and his friends what he's been through and what's happened that day, and they give him the good news. You ain't gonna make it, buddy. If this is what's happening, you better leave this Mordecai guy alone. Because you're gonna be in big trouble. And about that time, the people knock on the door to bring him to the dinner with Esther and the king. And he goes, and they eat. And the king says to the queen, why did you call us? What is it that you want? And Esther says, it's about me and my people. I wouldn't trouble you with this if we were going to be made slaves. I wouldn't trouble you with this if we were going to be moved to a different country. I wouldn't trouble you with this if it were anything else, but a man has made a decree to kill every single one of us. And I beg for my life and for the life of my people. And the king said, who has done this? And the queen says, it is Haman. And the king is so angry, he walks out of the room onto the balcony, and Haman falls on the bed, the sofa, place where they're eating, where Queen Esther is. And the king immediately turns and comes back in and he says, look at this man. He even attacks the queen in the presence of the king. And one of his servants comes up to him and says, he's built a gallows in order to hang Mordecai. And the king says, take him and hang him on it. And they take Haman and they hang him on it. Why is that tied with humor? Why would I use that as an example of God's humor? Well, number one, when you look at that story, it's flat out funny. And you can almost imagine all that is going on. But why is it intended to be funny? And why is this a picture of the humor that God describes for himself? Open your Bibles and read with me. God laughs. We'll start here. Psalm chapter 2, verses 1 through 6. And I want you to think about something as we read these verses. And here's what I want you to think about. I want you to think about all that's going on in our country and in our world today. The attitude toward God and those who believe in God. And the concern that we have for what's going to come next. And no doubt, it can be very difficult for us. But if we can just remember some verses like this, it might help us a bit through those difficult times. Psalm chapter 2, starting with verse 1. Why are the nations in an uproar? And the peoples devising a vain thing? The kings of the earth take their stand, and the rulers take counsel together. All the rulers of the world come together. And they've come together against the Lord and against His anointed, saying, let us tear their fetters apart, no longer bound by His word, no longer bound by Him, no longer bound by the idea of Him. We will treat Him as if He's dead and He no longer exists. We will no longer be bound by anything that He says. And cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. There it is. He who sits in the heavens laughs. And the Lord scoffs at them. Then He will speak to them in His anger and terrify them in His fury, saying, but as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. You see what these stories are about? What the book of Esther is about? Don't you just love it when the one who does absolutely wrong gets what's coming to him? Don't you just love it when the ones who absolutely reject God and destroy humanity from the way we were intended to be has exactly what He intended for others to be turned on Him? That's God's justice. That's the God of justice. And the emotion that God chooses to use when He thinks about and looks at all these people who absolutely turn their back on Him and deny Him and refuse to be bound by anything with reference to God, He laughs at them. They don't know how foolish they are. They don't know how absolutely silly they are. Chapter 37. This will be a longer reading. I think it's important to see the context, so I want you to read it with me. We'll try to shorten the other ones up. Psalm chapter 37, starting with verse 1. Be encouraged by these words, and recognize that the words that strike terror in us do not strike any terror in God. And the words that so concern us by our fellow men is not one bit a concern to God. Do not fret because of evildoers. Be not envious toward wrongdoers. For they will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord and He will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in Him and He will do it. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your judgment as the noonday. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for Him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way. Because of the man who carries out wicked schemes, cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It leads only to evil doing. For evildoers will be cut off. But those who wait for the Lord, they will inherit the land. Yet a little while, and the wicked man will be no more. And you will look carefully for his place, and he will not be there. But the humble will inherit the land and will delight themselves in abundant prosperity. The wicked plots against the righteous and gnashes at him with his teeth, and the Lord laughs at him because he knows his foolishness. He has no idea who he's dealing with. But God knows exactly who he's dealing with. And so God laughs at him. Chapter 52. Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man? The loving kindness of God endures all day long. Your tongue devises destruction like a sharp razor, a worker of deceit. You love evil more than good, falsehood more than speaking what is right. You love all words that devour, O deceitful tongue. But God will break you down forever. He will snatch you up and tear you away from your tent and uproot you from the land of the living. The righteous will see and fear and will laugh at him. The righteous will laugh when God takes care of the wicked. And that's what God would have. Chapter 59, 1 through 8. Start looking at verse 6. Talking about the wicked and the evil. They return at evening, they howl like a dog and go around the city. Behold, they belch forth with their mouth, swords are in their lips, for they say, "Who hears?" But you, O Lord, laugh at them. You scoff at all the nations. God laughs. Last one. Proverbs chapter 1. Wisdom is personified in chapter 1. This is the wisdom that comes from God. And here's what wisdom says. Wisdom shouts in the street. I'm in chapter 1, verse 20. Wisdom shouts in the street. She lifts her voice in the square. At the head of the noisy streets, she cries out. At the entrance of the gates in the city, she utters her sayings. How long, O naive ones, will you love being simple-minded? And scoffers delight themselves in scoffing, and fools hate knowledge. Turn to my reproof. Behold, I will pour out my spirit on you. I will make my words known to you. Because I called and you refused, I stretched out my hand and no one paid attention. And you neglected all my counsel and did not want my reproof. I will also laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your dread comes. Do you know what emotion that gives to me? And I think the emotion that God intended for us to have. When you see the foolishness of men on display, thinking that they can stand toe-to-toe against God and become victorious, and they pay no attention to what he says and no attention to his word, they are bored with it and they want to give no attention to it, I know what's going to happen. And I feel sorry for them. I know what's going to happen. And I dread it for them. Because they're about to meet a God who will absolutely destroy them. And so that's one of the motives for why we teach. One of the motives for why we try to persuade and get people to change their minds. Because God is not a God to be trifled with. And the foolishness of men is laughed at by God. And so we ought to have hearts of compassion that feel sorry for individuals that are like that and do what we can in a good way to persuade. But when we can't persuade, There's no reason to be afraid. And there's no reason to fear. Because we know exactly what's going to happen. And we know exactly what God is going to do. He laughs. And this is the description that the Bible gives to us of his laughter, and it's in connection with his judgment. But I feel absolutely certain and positive. People enjoyed being around Jesus and delighted to be in his presence because of the joy that they had in being with him. It's the same joy we get from being with one another. And it is the joy we will have in being in the presence of God forever. Because the God who gave us laughter knows how to laugh. And he knows how to laugh in a good way. Not just in a way where he is giving to those who disobey him and do not follow him exactly what they've asked for. There may be some here tonight who are ready to become a Christian by being baptized into Christ. There may be some here who would like to come home to Christ. If you need to respond to his invitation, we offer it to you as together we stand and as we sing.
Is a shelter.